What's Jennifer? Om Abhyayantu Mahagani Vakranaschakshushrotramatopalamindriyani Chasarvani Sarvam Brahma Upanishadam Maham Brahma Nirakuryam Mama Brahma Nirakarot Anirakaranamastu Anirakaraname Astu Taratmani Yate Yaha Upanishatsu Dharmaste Mai Santu Te Mai Santu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. So we didn't quite complete verse 2.4 of chapter Paribodhitam. So let's go ahead and chant that one. Paribodhitam matam.
Paribodhitam matam.
Amritatvam hi vindate.
Amritatvam hi vindate.
Atmana vindate viryam.
Atmana vindate viryam.
Vidyaya vindate mritam.
Vidyaya vindate mritam.
So, pratibodha viditam, a compound, pratibodha viditam. Matam amritatvam hi vindate. Atmana vindate viryam. Vidyaya vindate amritam. Okay, so. Pratibodha viditam matam brahma. Matam brahma. Brahman is known. Brahman is known when Pratibodha viditam. Brahman is known, or is to be known, you can even say. You can consider Brahman as being known, Brahma amatam. When what? Pratibodha viditam. When you recognize Brahman as that which is known in Pratibodha, every cognition means the consciousness, the satchit, the conscious being that is there in every cognition. Every cognition is different from every other cognition in terms of nama-rupa, in terms of the content, that which is known, the object of what is known, that continually changes infinitely. There's no end to it, really. Even if we look at all of our personal cognitions, it's endless. And then when we're talking about that which is kind of the adhishtana, the conscious being because of which these are known, that one is differentiated from your cognitions. It's differentiated from all cognitions. We have to look at it like this. From me, just in my own personal experience, this particular mind, right, has many, many cognitions. Those are variables because each thought is different from another thought. In fact, you can even say each vritti replaces the preceding vritti. So vritti, 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 vritti. The viditam, the consciousness, does not replace itself. The consciousness, the me, is the invariable. I mean, even in language we talk about that we don't really understand the implications of what we say in our language, but you can, if I say, even if you have no self-knowledge at all, well, you had this thought, then 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 you had this thought. Or I could say, I had this thought, then I had this thought, then I had this thought. The variable nature of the thoughts, the thought flow, for instance, is very well known by me. I would never say, you know, someone came in and had this thought, then another conscious being came in and had this thought, another conscious being had this thought. Would not even enter our vocabulary, right? It's not even a concept that we have. Because it's obviously, I am the one, I am the invariable, I am the one who is the conscious being because of which all of these thoughts are known. I can even say that as a total ajnani. I can say, You know, I am the one who is the knower of these thoughts. The knower remains constant. This word knower is problematic. It ends up being converted into just conscious being. But say, just as an Ajnani, I say, you know, all of these thoughts come and go. I'm the knower of the thoughts. All of the emotions come and go. I'm the one who's aware of these emotions. Now, it turns out that I also identify with the emotions and some of the thoughts I identify with. But even though I identify with them, I'll still say, yeah, I'm aware of this thought, I'm aware of this thought, I'm aware of this vritti, I'm aware of this vritti. So I'm the invariable. I'm always the invariable, no matter what the content of the vritti is, right? And so that invariable me is Brahman. The invariable is Brahman. Why do we say like the mind of the mind, the ear of the ear, the side of the side, except the eye of the eye, etc.? Because it shows that there's no distance between the invariable me and the vritti. There's no distance. It's not that I am the conscious being and a vritti is happening out here with a lot of space between me and the vritti. Right? There's no space at all between me and the vritti. So that brings this knowledge home. I have no problem at all with there being no space between me and the vritti if I say it like this. You know, I just had this thought, or I just had this feeling. I have no problem, you know. But when we get into this fancy language and we have the idea of moksha and the atma being non-dual and the same in all beings, then there's a certain kind of fear that takes place, you know, that what about me, the one who's the knower of the vritti? And so this Upanishad has its heart set on getting rid of that fear, you know, so that you can recognize that when we're talking about the one non-dual self, as we get into that, it's not some one non-dual self that I don't know. It's not a one non-dual self that I have to give up myself in order to be. And so there's all subtle kinds of fears around all of this, because enlightenment, moksha, liberation, these are all big words, you know. And these, like, just think of what, in the West, if we think of an enlightened being, you know, or a special being, we can think of Jesus who walked on water and walked on water. He walked along the ocean and he was able to turn water into wine, and he was able to raise the dead as Lazarus with Lazarus. You know, he did all kinds of things, you know. He had all kinds of siddhis, did all kinds of things. And so he was kind of our model for some of us as kind of an enlightened being. And so we can't walk on water, you know. We can't raise the dead. We can't turn water into wine. I mean, maybe you can. Maybe you could actually... Honestly, if you really want to be able to do those things, those are what we call siddhis, and you can spend your lifetime developing those capacities as siddhis, you know. But those siddhis that we have to remember now, those siddhis all, and the means for gaining all of those siddhis, you know, siddhi is these special capacities, like being able to, like, astral travel, or to read people's minds, or to turn water into wine, to do all of these kinds of things. Say we want to do all of those kind of things. Well, if you want to put in the time and you know all of the mantras and the different types of tapas and upasana that you have to do to gain some of these, a lot of them are probably told in the Atharva Veda, you know. And I'll just give you an example. Like, say, one that Swamiji brings up sometimes. Say you were like a rishi or a sannyasi in India back in the days of old, where you then went up into the Himalayas and you just made a little hut for yourself, a little place to be able to stay, and you cooked by the fire and all of this kind of stuff, you know. But there's a lot of snakes around, and so you had your meditation, and the meditation asana would be made of a deer skin, but the deer skin had to have a natural death. Then you could use that deer skin for your asana. So now you're sitting, meditating, trying to do your meditation, and you hear all this rustling around, and places loaded with snakes. So you decide that you want a siddhi that will keep all snakes away. There's actually a mantra for this. So the sadhu thinks, okay, let me just do this siddhi. I'll do it every day for a while. And so he gets the blessings from his teacher, who gives him that particular mantra and practice in order to remove the siddhi, to gain the siddhi that will keep snakes always away. So the teacher looks it up in the Atharva Veda, and he finds that particular mantra. In fact, Swamiji has a text, or had a text that had all of these magical mantras in them, including the snake, by the way. Okay. There's lots of them. Okay. And so the rishi here, or the teacher, gave his student this mantra. You just chant this mantra. Oh, thank you so much, Swamiji. How many times should I chant the mantra? Well, according to this, you have to chant that mantra 500,000 times. And if you chant it for, of course, the mantra is 2 lines long. So that takes, each mantra probably takes 30 seconds to chant. And so you need to chant this mantra for 500,000 times. And I'm not kidding, okay? And then you will be blessed with that particular siddhi. So now say you wanted another one. Say you have your own siddhis, you know. I would really, really like to be able to touch people and cure them, you know, by giving them my prana to cure them, okay? Because I want to be a doctor in that way, where I want to be, you know, this kind of alternative form of healing. I want to be able to pass my shakti on to them. So you ask your teacher, and your teacher says, well, that's a bigger one than the snake bite. Mm-hmm. But that one, you need to do this particular mantra 2 million times. Yeah. Now, this is an interesting thing. I've never done anything 2 million times, nothing. But just so that you know, just so you have this little sense of these siddhis and how they work, apparently, from the tradition, once you gain a siddhi, which takes a huge amount of time and a huge amount of work, you have to really want that, you know. Once you gain it, you have it. Forever. As long as you're a jiva, you have that siddhi. When you take another birth, you have that siddhi still. So they say. So if you're a siddhi seeker, or in a last life, you acquired in some time a particular siddhi, according to the tradition, which I don't know that much about really, but just according to the tradition, you have that siddhi forever. I think it talks about this in the Panini Yoga Sutras in the 3rd chapter. There's a whole section on siddhis, right? And in that chapter they say, please don't get into this because it's a distraction from your gaining self-knowledge, because now what you want to do is stay here in samsara, practicing as a doctor, perhaps an alternative doctor that you did by healing, or you want to be a mind reader, or you want to be able to hear what dead relatives are saying so that you can help soothe the grief of the mourning person, you know. So this is your wish. Your wish could as well be, you know, I want to be a concert pianist. You know, I want to be a concert pianist. That's what I want. I want to be the number one tennis player in the world. That's my desire. Well, if you want to be a concert pianist, I know a couple of them actually, or students of mine. You have to practice, if you're willing, and it's really you have the desire, you can practice, you know, 8 hours a day for years and years and years. If you, and then you can attain that. You can attain that if you have any natural talent. It's good if you're born with a few samskaras. But if you have those samskaras and you really devote your time to it, you can become a concert pianist. Swamiji, I told you this, I think, Swamiji had a lot of pressure put on him, but so many musicians knew him. He had such a wonderful voice, beautiful voice, beautiful rhythm, you know. And he just musical. And so musicians that were known to him really wanted, when he was a young man, really wanted him to become, you know, a singer, you know, within the Indian tradition. And he loved singing. He would be singing all the time. He makes up songs a whole life, you know, singing and making up songs. And for riding with him in the car, he'll be singing bhajans. And with that beautiful, compelling voice. But he said no, because That's not where, how he wanted to devote his time. It's not how he wanted to devote his time. He wanted to totally gain this knowledge. That's what he wanted, you know, to gain it, to mature in it, to teach it. That was what he wanted. That's the difference between a mumukshu and a samsari. A samsari wants to focus on something, whatever, if they want to focus at all, I mean, if they have that kind of sattva rajas predominant, you know, they want to be able to focus on something and gain a certain mastery of that and have that to offer the world, you know. But what they're wanting is an accomplishment within samsara, which definitely has usefulness and it has many nice things about it, you know, but that's the goal. For mumukshu, those accomplishments you may, your prarabdha, the work that you do, and the way that you make money, the way that you help others, that's all the prarabdha, but that's not your goal. That's not what your life is about. Your life is about gaining this knowledge. And so here, I'm kind of slowly moving us into the next verse, into the next line. They say here, it's for the mumukshu, what does it mean now to know Brahman? Is it an accomplishment of siddhis? Is there something that I have to gain to become this enlightened being? What does it have to do with? Is there an Atma, a Brahman, a non-dual self that I have to, you know, meditate in order for my mind, me, this is the issue here, for me, means my mind, for me to have a samadhi experience of that self, which is unknown to me because that's the big capital S self, and I'm the little self, my mind, I'm the little self, mind. I have to have an experience of this big capital S self. But then there's a lot of fear in that, because what about me? I don't want to be the big capital S self if I am going to kind of give up the ghost, if I'm not going to be here anymore, if I have to merge into something that I'm not, and we have all this language, I have to merge into the big capital S self to be liberated. And so then that big self I don't know. And I have to give up myself, merging into that or to become that. I don't know if any of you have had any of these problems, but they're kind of serious problems, actually, because of the fear that comes from that. And so this Upanishad definitely doesn't want you to have that unnecessary delusional fear that has nothing to do with reality. It has nothing, zero, to do with reality. It's just more jnanam, more samsara, more pain, more frustration. It has nothing to do with the vision of the Upanishads. This beautiful Upanishad wants to make you recognize something complete, something else. And that something else is in so, when once we understand it, it is so obvious. That something else is that the one that the nature, the one that the Upanishad is revealing or making you understand contextually, is the me that is already me. There is no distance between the me, the self that the Upanishad is unfolding, and the self that I am right now. So when I say, you know, I am a conscious being, and we're not using some other kind of magical language, I just, yeah, I'm, if I say I'm a conscious being, we don't usually talk like that, but I would say, if I ask you, are you a conscious being? I would probably say, well, I don't walk around talking like that, but I do exist, I am, and I am conscious, yes. So yes, I am a conscious being. So it's that conscious being. Now what if I ask you, yes, definitely I'm a conscious being. Do you think that you are present, or are there present in every thought that you think? Or is there somebody else there? Like say you have a thought, is that thought your thought? Are you as a conscious being present to the thought? Are you there? Is it your thought? You can't very well say no. You could either say, I don't know. I don't know the thoughts that come my way. No, that's not true. Every thought that you have, every emotion that you have is known to you. It is your thought and it is known. It is your emotion and it is known. Right? So that's this pratibodha. Pratibodha means every single thought, every single cognition, whether it be an emotion, you know, the whole spectrum of emotion, or it be any type of vritti, a memory, for instance, or an imagination, or any type of vritti that comes from out of your means of knowledge, like your perception, any vritti, doesn't matter what it is, any vritti, any, even an ajnana vritti, nobody cares, just vritti, period. That vritti is my vritti, right, when I'm just talking normally. My vritti means what? I am the one for whom this vritti is. Because of me, this vritti is known. This vritti comes and goes. It is my vritti, this vritti has come, here it is, and now it goes. So I don't think anyone is going to question that. In fact, we use this, just the example that I just gave, as a really important type of viveka. Because it's so easy in a way. Like if I say to you, you know, you are not your thoughts. In the sense, you are not the content of your vritti. Because the vritti comes and goes. Like if I tell, and people go, oh, that's true. It means this. Okay, this thought comes, it is known, and it goes. The next thought comes, it is known, and it is goes. That's true. Thought. We call it the flow of vrittis. True. In fact, in Vipassana, we sit there and just relax and just let those vrittis come. Let them come and, oh, your only task is just to be present to that. And so, yeah, we can do that. But when you, even in your life experience, the fact is that every thought that you have is your thought. It is known. Your thought means it is known. But it's not you. It's not you, because your thoughts come and go. But you are the one for whom those thoughts are. But the thoughts come and go. Now what if I was to just, like I'm saying that to you now, is anybody going to say, first of all, I don't think the thoughts come and go. Well, what do they do then? Does it, you know? Okay, say this, I'd always thought thoughts come and go, but if they don't, then okay, here comes the thought, and that's it. That's it. Okay, you're dead. You're done. This is it now. Okay. What do they think about it? They come and go. I don't come and go. Because that's the next ridiculous thing to say. Okay, the thoughts come and go. And so do you. Say we both are coming and going. That would be so confusing. Because, like, who's there for which thought? You know, and what if they're coming and going at different paces? You know? But that's not our experience at all, you know? So I am the one because of whom, really, I can say they're my thoughts, even though they come and go. I say they're my thoughts because I remain and the thoughts come and go. And because of me, you know, the one who I am and I exist, and when this thought, whatever the thought is, when it comes, it is there, it exists, and it is known. And when it goes, it's not that. This is another thing. We don't think about this, but when we point it out, just think of it, okay, this thought comes, and it is known. And so now it goes. Does it go along with the it is and it is known? No, not at all. Does it come? It is known. Does not happen at all. So now, in reference to these vrittis, they are there when they're there. So they come into whose being? They come into my being. They come into my consciousness, my existence. You can use the word my just for now. They come through my consciousness, my existence, and then they go. And I am left. I haven't come into being. I haven't gone out of being. All of my experiences come into my being and go out of my being. All experiences. The experience of the body. The experience of the sense organs. The experience of my memories. The experience of my emotions. The experience of this world. The experience of absolutely anything that can be objectified, which is the whole samsara, including space. Space, air, fire, water, earth, all of the elementals, all of the modifications of these five elements, all of them are objectifiable. They just have to fall within my purview. You know, they just have to be within my scope. And then all of them are known just by merely opening my eyes. That's all that's required. There they are, known. But we have to go further than that and realize that actually every single thing, internally as well as externally, those are known. In fact, it's not a vritti unless it is known. But the knownness is me. I am the conscious being, and that is invariable. That's why the other day we did this meditation, you know, where you kind of do this viveka and then you just focus on yourself and let's see, let's put a bag over it. Let's try to make it non-exist. Let's try to change it, try to make it do something, get away for the time being. You can do that with everything else, anything objectifiable. You can do that. You can't do that with yourself. Right? And so that's very beautiful me, not another me. Just the me that is me. I am the Adhishtana. I am the one because of whom all of these vrittis are known. And because of whom all of these vrittis exist. They don't have that on their own. They're not self-evident. A vritti isn't floating around self-evident me. No. It requires consciousness for it to be known. That's just how it is. You can't make it otherwise, actually. You don't require consciousness to be known because you are consciousness. Yourself is a conscious being. You don't need a vritti to light you up, right? Vrittis don't light anything up. I am the consciousness, the conscious being, because of which the vrittis are lit up, because of which the vrittis are known. But I don't need a vritti, or I don't need another person, another Atma, another consciousness to light me up, because I'm already lit up as consciousness. So I am my own non-dual experience. Why I say non-dual is because, for my own self, no subject-object relationship is necessary for me to be and to be known. With the rest of the world, everything objectifiable, the entire Ishwar, the whole thing, Ishwar and everything in it, requires consciousness. Conscious being for it to exist and for it to be known. Only the self doesn't require that. And that self is who? Is me. It's the me that is here right now as me. Not a capital S me that now I have to meditate to see if I can find it. You know? Where is that thing? I remember all that. Where is it? So sad. Swamiji lost all his hair during this. Poor guy. He says it. I lost all my hair. I needed that one old cranky sadhu to just give me his few lectures and straighten it all out. And he did straighten it all out. Such a relief. God. Okay. So there's no one else. There's nowhere to go. It talking only about you. You're the bottom line. There's no one behind you illumining you. There's no big self looking down upon you that you now have to merge into. You are that big self. There's no other big self. And you are the one who's really the sat-chit, the conscious being of every thought that you have. So to know yourself, not as some big S self, capital S self, to recognize yourself, the Upanishads are also, you know, the Kena Upanishad, you are the ear of the ear, the eye of the eye, the, you know, the prana of the prana, the mind of the mind, all of these things, so that you become near means they're not talking about something that's away. There's talking, I couldn't be more near. Now he says it again to kind of capsulize this, the whole thing. You are that which is viditam, that itself which is known as self-evident, really, there in every vritti, pratibodha. Bodha means every knowledge. Knowledge means vritti. This is known, this is known, this is known. Every thought is known. So all of these nama-rupas, all of these content of every vritti, right, it is pratibodha. Each one is known. Each vritti as it comes, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. The vritti is all changing. You are the viditam. You are the is-knownness of that vritti. Right? So just look at the vritti. Every vritti, no exception. This thought is known. This thought, content, totally different. This thought is known, this thought is known, this is the thought is known. That's pratibodha. Every single vritti, every single knowledge that comes your way, who are you in that? Viditam. You are that which is known. Viditam means it is known. So Brahman, Brahma Matam. Brahman is known as what? As that which is known in every vritti. It's the self-evident consciousness. And then Namarupa, self-evident consciousness, plus name and form. Because the vritti, really, because of your pramanas or your memories or whatever, the vritti has content. Every vritti has content, and that content is known. That is knownness, that consciousness, that conscious being, is Brahman. When that is known as Brahman, when you know that, means when you know Brahman in this way, which is knowing your own self, it says then, amritatvam vindate, then you gain immortality. Immortality means freedom from death. Why do you gain freedom from death? Because you're not a vritti. You're not objectifiable. Right? The viditam, just think about it. That which is viditam, that which is known in every experience, doesn't come and go. But every experience does come and go. Just like saying, every vritti, every experience I have. So vritti is an experience. I'm not talking about the viditam. The viditam is Brahman. That's the is-knownness that the experience enjoys. There is no stable experience by its nature. Every experience comes and goes. It comes into being, it goes out of being. It is really nothing but change. It is subject to infinite change. And when we say change, another way to say that, it is subject to continual birth and death. There's only one thing that's not subject. Even if you look at the vritti, this experience, this experience, this experience, when an experience is replaced, it's gone. You can say it's dead, okay. It's been born and it dies. It's been born and it dies. Because it's not available anymore, it's gone. Okay? And so the entirety of your experience is birth and death, birth and death, birth and death, birth and death, which is another word for change. But that birth and death, birth and death, birth and death takes place in conscious being, which has no birth and death. Conscious being is not walking around within duality to be subject to birth and death. You need time for birth and death. Consciousness has no time. It's the presence of time. It's the presence of the present. You have no experience whatsoever of a change in your being, in conscious being. You can't. It's impossible. And you can't try to make it change. That's a good meditation. Let's make it die, okay? Let's make it go away. Let's turn our back on it. Anything. It's so fun to try because absolutely nothing happens. Nothing. Your mind is going through all of these kind of hoops, jumping through all these hoops to see if you can block out just the changelessness of your being, and it's impossible to do that. You can do it with anything within time. Any experience within time. And even if you don't do it, it'll do it to you. Because there's no experience within time that doesn't change. And so when you know yourself, when you know Brahman, when you really know Brahman means that I know that me, that the Atma, the self that I am, is Brahman, I am free from death because I am not these things that come into being and go out of being. I am the Adhishtana. In fact, I'm very much a different order of reality. I say that because within duality, there is nothing that is not bound by time. Within samsara, every experience is bound by time, is bound by change, without exception. Yeah. The self is free of time. There is nothing, your being is free of time. You are the Adhishtana. You are the being itself, which all of this changing phenomena depends upon. Right? And so you being free of time are not an object in the creation. Because the creation, there is nothing free of time in the creation. The creation is continually changing by its nature. So this is one order of reality that has no being of its own. Why? One very good reason is that everything in the creation is continually changing, and that means every experience that you have is bordered by non-existence. It comes into being and goes out of being. Nothing comes from non-existence because it's not there. And so this whole creation is coming into being, going out of being, coming into being, going out of being. Every experience you have. But the being it's coming into and going out of is not coming into being and going out of being. It's a different order of reality. It's the substratum. I am the substratum, the Adhishtana of all of this Maya. But this Maya, you know, that since it has no being of its own, can it even experience itself or exist without any being? We'd say, no, it's non-existent because it has no being. It's non-existent because it has no existence. But of course, we never experience that because Maya enjoys me. I am its existence. But I, the one who am its existence, it is, that isness is not objectifiable. I'm a different order of reality. And you know, just like you're a different order of reality, you, this very personal me, you are a totally different order of reality from your dream or from your imagination. Imagination is wonderful to play with that. And if I tell you, you know, you're really a different order of reality from your imagination, and you kind of look at me like, thanks for letting me know. You know? It's so obvious, you know. You imagine something. That imagination comes from you, sustained by you, it results. This is all we teach in Vedanta. But we teach about this universe. But Bhagavan gave us this imagination and the dream as kind of the Achilles heel to help us as a drishtanta, the most perfect drishtanta, to understand the relationship between me as the Adhishtana, the reality of the imagination or of the dream. How can we have a better example? Because with there you understand the mityatva of the imagination, and you understand yourself as the satyam of the imagination. You are the existence, the consciousness, which this imagination enjoys. That existence, consciousness is there before the imagination, during the imagination, and after the imagination. It's really kind of the same thing as saying, I am here before the vritti, during the vritti, and after the vritti. And I'm here for the next vritti also. It's exactly the same, but now we're just using the word imagination because then we have our own little world with little beings in the world, you know. And then we can even say, and you know, from the standpoint of the beings walking around, little people and animals and whatnot, walking around in your imagination, what do you think their experience is? Their experience is I'm a person walking around in my world here. And I have my dog with me and my friends. You know, that's who I am. That's Ajnanam. How can you expect that dream, that little person, is not, they're not little for themselves, they're walking around in whatever the imagination is. Why would they say anything different? That ignorance is intrinsic to the situation. They're not going to say, unless somebody has painstakingly taught them using the pramanas that have been handed, pramana that's been handed down from beginningless time, because the teachers themselves say, we have no idea how to teach you this, but we teach you this in the way that our teachers taught us, which goes back to Ishwara. You know? So why would the little character in your imagination be different? So it thinks itself as the real being, and then an imaginal guru has to come in and do all this viveka, all this vichara, to make them recognize, oh my gosh, I'm the Adhishtana of the imagination. I'm the self of the whole imagination and every part of it. I'm the Ishwara of the imagination, and I'm all of the jivas of the imagination. I am every being in that imagination, and I'm free of every being in the imagination. That's why playing with your imagination in reference to the Vedanta that you've learned in reference to this creation can be really, really very beautiful thing. So now say, you recognize that Paribodha Viditam, you recognize that as Brahman. Where is there any death for you? You are the Adhishtana. When you withdraw your imagination, has anybody died? So you have an imagination and all these little creatures are running about and all the people are running around, and then the all-powerful you withdraws them. Okay? You just wiped out all these people. Was there any death experience for anybody? Anybody? No, because they didn't die. There was no death experience because nothing happened, because it's a different order of reality that has no being of its own, and your being is not touch. Your consciousness is not touch. The me is not touched. So you gain this amritattvam, the state of never being subject to death, because the ahankara has been removed. That I notion has been removed. Because you've actually never at any time experienced any type of death. So even say you're just the raving atheist, you know, there is nothing but this physical world. You know? That is it. And of course I am this physical body. That's fine. I mean, there's good reasons for thinking that, because you can't really prove otherwise. You need some shraddha to be able to be taken step by step by step. With your means of knowledge, you can't prove anything else really. But with an Upanishad, with those, that means of knowledge, you're taking step by step by step to the actual aparoksha jnanam, the direct, immediate realization of your own being. You're taking step by step to the direct, immediate realization of something, myself, which is free of death. And so that's not something that can be denied. It becomes what we call in any logical syllogism, I forgot the word right now, but anyway, in any logical syllogism, if the first statement isn't true, even within a samsara, if the first statement of a logical syllogism isn't true, then the result of the syllogism, all of the steps also, will give you something false, because the initial, what we call, in Sanskrit, we call pratignya. The pratignya, the initial statement itself, is false. But say here, the initial statement is not false, it is not dual, non-dual, and you use means of knowledge to see it beyond, to recognize it beyond any doubt whatsoever. And once that is known, there is like an infinity of logics to establish it. It's just those logics can't establish that initial pratignya, that initial statement. But the initial statement is self-evident once recognized. And so once that is known, as you, and as you recognize that about yourself, where would the death experience be? You know, when you're losing this body, and say there are different types of death, some are much more painful than others, some people really suffer when the body is sick, and some people just drop dead and they don't have to go through any of that. But that's all on the level, physical level. There's no dropping dead for yourself. There's just the body and whatever it went through in the dying process, that suffering I'm aware of. Just like now, if you get sick, you're aware of it. And you suffer from it also. Swamiji had all these issues and, you know, different bypasses and this and that. Those are all pretty big operations, and they were not fun for him. He just bears it and doesn't complain. But any normal person would realize he was really bearing a lot, even though he doesn't do anything about it. He just does it. But it wasn't fun, you know. But even while all that was going on, there was absolutely nothing happening to himself. And when the body dropped, there was nothing happened to himself at all. Nor did he expect anything to happen, because he already is his self. And there's no possibility. It's a different order of reality. There is nothing that can happen to me. I just simply am, free of time. And so that is myself. And so this, when that's the case, one gains this amritattvam. In your mind, you recognize what has always been there. It's not like you're becoming immortal all of a sudden. You've always been this. Now you're recognizing it. And so now he says in the second line, Atmana Vindate Viryam. One attains, right? The Viryam. Viryam means strength or capacity. One gains the capacity what? To what? The capacity to gain this knowledge. Atmana. Atmana here can mean two things. We're going to do this in two different ways. So, vindate, that one gains. Viryam, the strength, the capacity to gain this knowledge is understood. By themselves, by the self. Here, by the self, the first meaning is atma prayatnena, by one's own self-effort. Here, atma doesn't mean the atma, which is Brahman. It just means me. Because of my efforts, by my efforts, I gain the capacity to gain this knowledge. So what do they mean by efforts? By my efforts. And it's not just efforts. It's not just yatna. It's not atma yatnena from the commentary. It's not atma yatnena. I'll do this effort, I'll do that effort. No, it has to be prayatna. Prayatnena. By the appropriate efforts, then with that I gain the capacity, the viryam. Viryam means strength. I gain the strength, the capacity to be able to get this knowledge. So why do they not say, I gain the capacity to gain this knowledge by karma, by my actions, or even to say by karma yoga. By karma yoga. He just says by yourself. You gain the capacity for this knowledge by your own efforts, through your own efforts. Why that's important is that we think that there are certain efforts, like if I do this thing and I do this thing and I do this thing, then I'll have the muscles or whatever, or the mental capacity to gain this knowledge. And so then I have a list of these things, of practices. But that isn't true. There isn't really a list of practices. There is a list of attitudes. Attitudes. The attitudes that can be as though practiced or understood in reference to every single thing that you're doing in life. That's why this is important. Well, if I do this practice and this practice, then I'll gain, the viryam, the strength, the capacity to gain self-knowledge. That isn't true. You can live whatever life you're living. Whatever your prarabdha is, that is fine. You're in practice, right? This is your practice. Every moment is your practice. Because the practice doesn't have to do with the things or the people or the objects. It has to do with, how can you be with your life in a way that is an expression of Dharma, but is also an expression of Dharma, because I said that's so overarching. Or I could say an expression of ahimsa, non-injury, which is the highest, it's at the top of the Dharma, triangle, so to speak. Ahimsa is there at the top. The golden rule is next. We want to go down what we call sadhana dharma, the dharma that are for all human beings, not just for Indians or Westerners or Europeans, for all living beings. That you could say that ahimsa, non-harm, injury is the top. The golden rule in India, it's do unto others as you would have done to yourself. And don't do to others as you would not want them to yourself. They do both sides. It's kind of nice. So that's underneath, Then I've said often, I think in this class, way back when, or maybe it was at Mangalam, what is the beautiful positive word for ahimsa, non-injury? Because ahimsa is what not to do. And so it's practicing ahimsa. It's kind of interesting, that's fine, just, don't let me hurt anybody. But what's, or any animal, don't let me hurt any living being. Let that be my value, not that we can always practice that. We do our best. This is important to understand also. But what is our value toward every experience that we have? That we can actually practice to give us that antakarana shuddhi that allows my mind to have the capacity, the strength, the shanti to be able to gain this knowledge. So I don't have to go and find a different situation. The situation, your prarabdha is fine. It's packed with all kinds of things. It's packed with lots of beautiful things and lots of problems. Bhagavan makes sure she needs this problem. She needs to work on this one little thing. Let's give her that one. Okay. You'll get all of your all of them. Everything that needs to be worked on will just be given to you nicely in your situation. So what would be like the positive of ahimsa is, I think, kindness. The practice of kindness. I think I've told you this, right? That the Dalai, I got it because I saw this word on a bumper sticker, the Dalai Lama's bumper sticker. You know, where it's a famous bumper sticker. So in the States, he says, kindness is my religion. So I thought, that's the perfect word. Ahimsa, when you put a negative, that's in a way better because there's so many things, so many ways of being in the world that are not harmful, you know. So when you just say ahimsa, non-injury, then all of the hundreds of positive words can come. There's so many ways of being in the world that is not hurting anyone, you know. And so doing that negative opens up a big display of positive, right? But then say you want. You can just think about this yourself because they're more operational. You know, if you're doing a research dissertation, you know, what are the variables, what things, how do you operationalize this question? How do you practice that, you know? What are the ways of making that, of working through that? So here, how do you operationalize ahimsa? You know, what would be one positive word that you can practice which encompasses itself positively so many different variables? And that could be kindness. If you just think of it. And so if that becomes your dharma, just another word for dharma in a way. It's a beautiful word because if you think of in your own experience, you know, because it, in terms of dharma, we always know what is dharma in terms of how we want to be treated, you know. We don't need to be taught dharma. We know dharma in terms of ourselves, what we would love to have from other people. We want people to love us, to like us, to respect us, to care about us, to help us when we're down. You know, all of these things are just human things. We want to be given the benefit of the doubt. We want to be able to be respectfully helped. You know, not okay, I've got to help her again, or him again. There's nothing kind in that. Nobody wants that kind of help anyway. You know? So, this training of the mind to live up to yourself, to live up to what you yourself want, to what is actually your human nature. This is your human nature. It's who you actually are. These other things like hurting somebody, being angry at somebody, all of the things that we can do and do, those aren't who we are. Those are all products of ignorance in the sense that I have fear that this person is going to take myself away from me. That's basically what it is. Because when you have projected yourself onto someone else, onto something else, then that somebody can take it away. You know? Somebody can ruin it for you. Really, it's very possible. And so we have all of these projections, you know, and they come up here and they come up there, and then you get afraid. Because it's like somebody taking yourself from you, you know? And that's not acceptable at all. You can say, I don't want you to kill me. Don't kill me. Don't ruin my life. I'm afraid of that. Usually when you think of raga dvesha, it's fear. It's fear. It's fear that somebody's going to take something away from you, you know? So you need actually To really be free of that, you need knowledge. You need really self-knowledge. But as a mumukshu and as you're gaining knowledge, you can bring your knowledge back continually. You know, to be able to neutralize these fears, you know, the dveshas. The positive ones you don't have to worry too much about unless you're very attached. If you can become very attached to something, then you have fear. So really what is core to our problems is that someone's going to take ourselves away. But when you have self-knowledge, you realize that they can't. They can't do nobody. You can't even do anything. Ishwara, Swamiji will joke, say, even Ishwara can't do anything. Because different order of reality. It's like the dream character trying to beat me up. Or say you're having imagination and there's this renegade person, you know, in the imagination trying to attack you. You know? And then what do you do? You know? You're going to have fear and, oh my gosh, like I'm watching a movie. But it's a mithya fear, you know? Or you go, like that, no. But it's not real. Not even to you, it's not real. So that's these practices I do to break the beginningless ajnanam that has caused beginningless reactions and pain in reference to the way I am in the world. Myself is being taken away from me. I don't, you say that, but this person's scaring me. They're making me unhappy. They're ruining my life. All, if this goes off, I'm on and on. What if when that's kind of stuff, these kind of things, you, because of your knowledge now, you just bring your mind back, you know? You can say, there's lots of little key things you can say. What are you afraid that is going to happen? What are you afraid of? And then bring your knowledge back. Sit with the little ones inside, bring your knowledge back. Be with yourself until the mind settles down. Give it a chance to settle down. You know, in the tremendous comfort of your knowledge, it will settle down. Sometimes it's a biggie, you have to wait for a while, you know. But that's what we have to do, you know. That's what gives the mind the viryam. The viryam means the relative shanti that then, in this last half, last pada, it says that being able to gain that knowledge, being able to see, have enough shanti to gain this knowledge, then by that knowledge, because of that knowledge itself is the amritam, the freedom from death. The knowledge itself is the freedom from death in that you recognize that you've never died, you will never die, you can never die, you will just are what you are, free from time. But that requires a mind that has some space to be able to see that. And that space, that capacity, you can gain. Just whatever your life is, you don't bother to change it. Unless you want to change it, that's fine. But changing your life, you know, is not the point. It's how are you with your life? The whole life is a sadhana for gaining that antakarana shuddhi. That's what it is. And in that knowledge, you recognize yourself as free from death. You recognize the reality of that.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om.
I'll just tell you, I want to talk about tomorrow.